I offer myself to thee to take with me and build with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Please take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I'd help. Of thy love and thy power and thy way of life, may I do thy will always. And that's about as good as it gets, really. If I could live like that, man, every single day and minute of my life, I wouldn't have anything to talk about. So Irish meals. I'm actually, thanks to my good friend Randy, I'm now in possession of my complete heritage, thanks to his second cousin twice removed. I found out that I'm Irish on both sides of my family, and I don't recall that much fried chicken in our history back in the old days. I love it. I think this take on Irish food is much better, you know, because what I was told is my idea of a seven-course Irish meal is a potato and a six-pack, right? So anyway, I've been giving a little thought to it because I hadn't told my story in a long time. Other than the brief little minute I spoke at 112, I don't know, maybe a year ago, maybe a little less. And what I've been fascinated with is this idea, because I started drinking when I was 15, and this idea, or reality really, but this concept that I was so maladjusted to life by the time I was 15 years old that alcohol was my solution. And how tragic that is. Not that I'm a tragic case or anything, but I mean how tragic it is for anybody, any child, to feel like they don't belong. And how common that is amongst us, at least the people that I've gotten gut level honest with. I've given a little bit of, like I said, a little bit of thought to it. And one of my earliest childhood recollections is that of not belonging and not fitting in. You know, I remember I was a constant discipline problem. And I remember even as early as kindergarten and before being separated from and put over here because I wasn't right. I wasn't fitting in. I wasn't doing the right thing at the right time with the right people ever. And always felt different from and apart from everybody. I mean, including my parents. So it's kind of a weird feeling. And I kept that feeling till I found you folks, by the way. You know, because alcohol didn't take that away for me completely. What it did was temper it and tamp it down enough that I could at least be around you without crawling out of my skin for a long time. Just early childhood memories of embarrassment, you know, just mortal embarrassment. You know that when you're a child, the emotions are either high or low, right? Anything is, it's either the greatest thing I've ever seen or it's the worst possible thing that's ever happened to me. And I remember so many of those worst possible things that ever happened to me. And trust me, I'm of the belief that you can't really trust childhood memories. But I do know that I was constantly being removed from places and put somewhere else and told that I'm going to have to do different to be here, that I wasn't getting along and wasn't fitting in. And y'all may think this is funny. I do, but. I decided I was going to tell y'all this. I remember distinctly, first grade, and I crapped my pants in class, okay, in the middle of class, right, during the class. It didn't say a word, just sat there, and the teacher was like, and made the whole class like look under their shoes and all that stuff, you know. And it finally got around to me. You know, of course I'm going to get busted in there. You can't keep that a secret as a six-year-old. And, they found me, marched me down, man. I was the kid that crapped his pants for, you know, however long that lasted, you know. Mom had to come get me, take me home, and all. I had to go back the next day, obviously, you know. So, I mean, it's just always just something that keeps me separate and not part of any community really at all, you know. And that's the kind of feeling that alcohol fixed for me, or at least, like I said, it didn't cure that in me, but it gave me enough ease and gave me something in common with you so that I could at least be there, you know, and be there. And so that's the story of so much of my life. My family put the funk in dysfunctional. Let me tell you, I don't talk about this much either because it's not all that important. But for the basis of building a picture and letting y'all know who I am, my household was very violent. My father was a rageaholic, and I was the oldest, and he used to whip my ass. I mean, a lot and hard, for anything. And so I took a lot of abuse as a child, and I really didn't realize how bad it was until I was an adult and saw that rage in me. Before I came into AA, but I saw that rage coming through me one time directed at a child that wasn't even mine. And I went, oh my God. So I had that kind of background too. I'm the oldest of two brothers. Oh, by the way, my sobriety date is 9/11/17. So I got a little less than 2 years. And my home group is the Page 112 group in Old Hickory. Sorry. That was the official thing I was supposed to say every time I get stand up in front of a group. And I caused myself to lose my train of thought right there by saying that. So anyway, father, alcohol, oldest of two brothers. I got a brother that's 3 years younger than me and another brother that's 8 years younger than me, and we're still very close, as close as brothers that don't live next to each other and don't talk to each other every day are. But we're close. We get together on holidays, weekends. We call each other for advice every once in a while, based on our specific trades, not like life advice, you know. And so it's not bad. It's not bad. Now, my father died about 12 years ago or so at this point. So, yeah, it was a strange upbringing. And I remember clearly, and take this for in the attention that I mean it in, you know, I was always the smartest kid in every classroom I sat in, I'll tell you that right now, and the most maladjusted and vicious and bitter kid that you've ever laid eyes on. You know, I just was. I was too much of a wimp to do anything outwardly to anybody, but I was hateful on the inside. I was full of hate. Whether I was raised that way or developed that as a defense mechanism, I got no earthly idea. But I was mad, and never did fit in with the cool kids, and never did fit in with the not so cool kids. Even though that's where I had to go to get anybody to hang out with, you know. So, about 14 or so, my buddies. Plus, I was also a little bit of a delinquent, by the way. My buddies, my best friend and I, we'd ride around and destroy things, and. We were vandals, and we would we burnt down a house in the woods that caused a big kerfluffle. We'd steal things and break them. You know, I mean, I'm in suburbia, right? This is not. I mean, we're like the neighborhood hellions for no real good reason. It's just that this kid would hang out with me, and I would do what he did, and then all of a sudden I liked it because it felt empowering, and so that's what the hell we did. But I never really got in a whole lot of trouble, legal trouble with all that, but I did get in a lot of trouble with my father for all that. So about 14 or so, they decided that they wanted to try pot. And I was all in. And you know, of course, I was the last guy on any totem pole. But they got what they thought was pot, and we tried to smoke it, and it wasn't anything but tea. Somebody had sold this kid some tea. And we tried to smoke. We didn't know any better, and thank God for that. I didn't try pot. And very soon after that, my family moved. My father had gotten a new job in New Orleans, and we moved from Atlanta to New Orleans. And so I started a new school, new kids, new everything. All at the right about the time I was really starting to go off the edge. And at that time, I was still maintaining good grades in school. I was still, at the top of my class all the way through. And we went to this little town outside of New Orleans called Covington, Louisiana, and it was just north of Lake Pontchartrain. So it wasn't really New Orleans, but it's, you know, you just say New Orleans so that you don't have to explain where Covington, Louisiana is. And I grew up there, and it's pretty backwoods back then. It's a pretty high-end town now. But back then, it was pretty backwoods town. Shell roads everywhere. Everybody talked with a coon-ass accent, you know what I mean? And everybody's highest aspiration I started in middle school again there instead of high school. I left in the eighth grade high school and then went into middle school in Louisiana. And the highest aspiration that anybody that I knew there had was to get on an offshore rig. And that's just all there was. So school and scholastics and doing anything didn't mean anything to these people. And so in my always unceasing desire to fit in and make somebody like me and not feel like an outcast, it became less important to me too. And I became a little bit of a delinquent as it related to school at that point. And along about 15 years old, this neighborhood kid that was an older kid, you know, the cool kid that you want to be like, he threw a party up the street, and there was a lot of the teenagers, the older teenagers were there, and anyway, I could go. They said I could come, and they made this big trash can full of hunch punch, you know, and it was really really good, and And so my first impact with alcohol, other than the beer, the Pabst, Falstaff beer I stole from my grandfather and drank in the middle of his farm like 10 years before that. But my only real first impact with alcohol, man, I drank to a blackout and fell all over, puked, did it all right then and there, first drunk. And there wasn't a magic light go on in me that said, oh, man, this is it. But what it was my ticket to be part of anything, you know. Even though I obviously drank alcoholically from the very first drink, the experience of at least being accepted into that group was pretty good for me, even though I was always the butt of all the jokes. And so it continued like that for a number of years. I wasn't very good at drinking, nor was I very good at drugging, and I always got caught at everything that I did eventually. And so of my friends, before I graduated, or I didn't graduate from high school, I ended up dropping out of high school. Dropped out of high school, I had amassed a pretty significant arrest record, you know, in Louisiana, and I'm not proud of it, but it's amazing that the period of time from maladjusted and can't fit in to groups, but still achieving academically, to skipping school, getting busted for all kinds of things, drugs and alcohol possessions, and I wasn't a burglar then anymore, but all the trouble that goes with being an alcoholic drug addict that is not good at it. within 3 years, that's where I was, you know, I'd made the newspapers a couple of times, you know, and not in a good way, and had a really really bad and wild reputation in this town of Covington, Louisiana. And ended up dropping out of high school, you know, within a couple years after I started drinking, and just threw it all away. I was sitting talking to Tony before the meeting, and my lifelong dream at that point was to be an airline pilot, a fighter jet pilot, and a pilot. And my dad had secured for me an entrance into the Air Force Academy, because at the time I was testing well and all that. I looked good on paper for a little while, and blew it. Just blew that out. Gone. Wasn't no way. Didn't even bother asking if I could still have it. I mean, we knew that was over with, and so I dropped out of high school and went on about my life. And at the time, my parents, my dad had lost that job, and they were going to move back to Atlanta, and I had gotten myself a pretty decent job. I was driving a Pepsi truck. I was a Pepsi route salesman, and I'd drive around and fill grocery stores and quick stops and build the display. I was a Pepsi salesman, And I'd gotten a pretty good job because down there you could get your CDL at 17 back then. You could get your driver's license at 15, CDL at 17. And so I had this job. And I was making real good money for a 17-year-old alcoholic. And I told him I wasn't coming back to damn Atlanta. Yeah, I'm going to make my way right here. You know what I mean? Right here and right now, this is going to be it. And and so off they went because they couldn't stop me, and I stayed down there for a while. And just still just so maladjusted to life, just still the only people that I really – I had two or three, you know, fellow addicted drunks that I would hang out with and whatever – people that those circles would touch every once in a while, but I was still unsuccessful at even really partying real well down there anyway. So I kept getting in trouble, and I decided that it'd be a brilliant idea. I moved in with this guy's brother, who happened to be the biggest drug dealer in Covington, Louisiana. That was my roommate. And I remember it. I mean, I'm not even going to apologize for talking about this. I remember sitting one night at his kitchen table, at the kitchen table, counting Quaaludes for him and putting them in bags. And we counted so many of the damn things that we got screwed up touching them and coming through your skin. You know what I mean? Just thousands of them and putting them into smaller bags and smaller containers and all that. And and I had tried my hand a couple of times at dealing dope, and never was really good at it because it turns out that I really couldn't find anything I didn't like taking. So what would end up happening is I would get some stuff and say, "Yeah, man, I'm going to pay you back $50 for that, you know, and I'm going to go make $100, right?" Well, no. Every time I just owed for it, and so I thought I'd try. Dealing these Quaaludes, and I got caught with them. Got caught with them, and that was I might have been 18 at that. I think I might have. No, I was still 17, almost 18 years old, and got caught with all these ludes, and so here I am in jail. And of course, I got priors because I was never really good at this stuff anyway, and always got caught at everything I ever did, every damn time. Eventually. And so I ended up in front of the judge, and again, I wasn't going to talk about this, but I was talking to Tony about this. Made a deal with the judge that and my dad and mom hired a lawyer, came down to help me get all this done, and made a deal with the judge, and I was going to join the army. You'll never see me again, man. The minute I walk out of this courtroom, I'm joining the army and leaving town. And what I did was leave town and never join the army. And I don't know how I get away with this stuff. I got away with that. Not that probably shouldn't have been and wouldn't have been the best thing that could have ever happened to me. I chose once again to make a left when I should have taken a right, and ended up moving back to Atlanta and falling right back into an alcoholic behavior. I didn't really do a whole lot of dope. After that, I started collecting DUIs, and I'm not going to make it a drunk log or any kind of log, but I'm not proud of this either. But by the time I finally quit drinking and driving, or at least by the time I quit getting caught at drinking and driving, I had amassed seven of the damn things. I was just like I said, man, I can't do anything without getting caught. That's why it's real hard for me to even though I became a pretty decent liar a little bit later on in life, I'm not real good at it because I'm eventually always going to get caught. I just am. I'm that guy. I got a son, by the way. My youngest son is cursed with this thing that no matter what he does, he gets caught at. Now, he isn't nearly as bad as I was. But he gets caught every time. And I was that guy, the guy that always got caught. And seven of those. So fast forward about 25 years old, I finally figured out how to not get arrested for partying, and did a bunch of the other stuff. It was a high and hard time at that time. At that point, it was about 19, mid to late 80s, early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, in that time. And we were running hard and fast, and I'd come back to Atlanta and gotten a job. And ended up quitting my last job in a rage. I'd worked myself into a pretty decent job with this construction company. And in a drunken rage, got mad at the owner because he offended me and quit. And instead of being smart enough to go back in and apologize, say, "Hey, man, I'm really sorry. I was drunk last night. I didn't mean any of that, man. Please forgive me. How can I ever make it up to you?" I showed up the next morning and got my stuff out of my desk, and because I was so proud. And at that point, I became unemployable. And ended up having to become self-employed, and I ended up working for myself for the next 20 years because I was a maniac, and started a locksmith company, and I was kind of self-taught, and bought a Southern Bell van and started a locksmith company in Covington, Louisiana, and ran it for 20 years, and it did all right. I mean, especially after I quit drinking, which is real soon now. I'm only 15 minutes in and I'm almost sober, so that's not bad. So you know, and I was still bouncing off the walls. I was a pretty decent salesman, you know, and I'm not a bad businessman, and I can do calculations and figures, and so I had a decent little small business going. I'd done the same thing for the guy that I quit, and ended up just going into business doing that. I quit a guy that was a glass contracting salesman, a glass contracting company. I started a glass contracting company that failed pretty quickly. But in that ensuing time, I'd also started a lock and key company with a guy. And so that ended up being the one that lasted forever, or until I sold it. And it was just normal, just stuff, man. I joined the JCs. I don't know if any of y'all ever remember the JCs, the Junior Chamber of Commerce, and they were real big in the county that I was in outside. Oddly enough, I moved from Covington, Louisiana to Covington, Georgia. And so in Covington, Louisiana, Covington, Georgia, I spent the 30-ish years of my life there, and I joined the JCs, and I was trying to be a legit business guy, but I was still drinking every single day. I tell you what, I was so blind to the consequences of my actions that, I mean, I had a van, right? It's painted white. It's got my business name and phone number all over the damn thing. It's a smallish town, especially back then. Everybody knew who the hell that was. And I was parked in front of the bar every damn day at 11 o'clock, man. Every day. Just drunk every day. Drunk every day. High every day. And like I said, I don't know why. I don't know whether it's because the cops just wouldn't pull me over because I was part of the community a little bit there. But I wasn't getting DUIs anymore. So I quit getting in trouble. And so it just went on that way for a long time. No real relationships. I mean, I'd end up with girlfriends or close friends, and they wouldn't last, and something would happen, and everything would blow up, and, you know, somebody's mad about something, and we'd just get drunk. Just get drunk, get high, and forget all about it. And it was kind of a wild way to live. But what ended up happening after joining the JCs is I ended up meeting my first wife, and it's the mother of my two children. And I don't know what her story is on this, because I was, without getting into too graphic a detail, I hardly ever slept. You can read into that what you want. I hardly ever slept and was drunk all the time. And she thought it was a good idea to marry me. And so we climbed on a damn airplane and flew to Las Vegas. And I had been on about a 3-week run, and just got married in Vegas, man. Craziest thing I ever saw, by a guy that, you know, in the little chapel of the stars, you know, He said, did you take, you know, I don't know if y'all know Ernest Angley. Y'all remember Ernest Angley off television? This dude reminded me just like Ernest Angley, you know. And so got married in Vegas, man, went back to the hotel, you know. What the heck, right? And so that was it. And and much to her chagrin, I was already pretty much in psychosis at that point. I mean, not that marrying her was a great thing and I got kids and blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, as far as my just walking around life, I was pretty much psychotic. And I got sober 6 months after I married her, after we got married. And that was in 1995. And it didn't sit well in my home. I got really sober really fast and had one of these damn hardcore big book shove it right up your hind end kind of sponsors. And I mean, the only appropriate answer for anything that he said was, yes, sir, may I have another, really. And I was willing to do that. And frankly, it was exactly what I needed to do. You know, this guy weighed 500 pounds, and that is not an exaggeration. He wanted to lose weight, and I, at the time, I was just getting into the fitness business a little bit, and so I was going to help him lose weight, and I couldn't find a scale that would register, that wouldn't max out. I had to take him to the recycling center and put him on the scale to get his actual weight, and it was like 502 pounds. You know, so, I mean, big boy. Yeah, and Big John. And Big John was Big John saved my life. Big John was actually, and still is, miserably crazy individual. But he saved my life. I mean, he looked me square in the eye. And he said, if I told you that to get sober, you'd have to get down on your hands and knees and push a marble around 285 traffic during rush hour with your nose, would you do that? You know, and I said, yes. And turns out, you know, he told me some months after, he says, I'm the only guy that ever said yes to that. But, I mean, I was willing because I'd spent about several months running from invisible people, you know what I mean, and not sleeping. And, I mean, all the psychosis that goes with that. You know, and it was just crazy. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous to get sober, I was ready to be sober by God, and did so. I had the steps worked in 9 months, and was sponsoring people before I picked up a year chip, and fit into Alcoholics Anonymous. I finally found y'all, son of a guns. I finally found you. I fit in to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I flourished there, and had a great life. Just to finish the train on about the marriage and the wife in the 6 months, she wasn't all that damn happy about me getting sober, and she told me so because she didn't like me sober. She liked me being the loud, arrogant, loudmouth drunk, you know, because I was kind of that guy that could fill up a whole room and brah, 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 and I'd tell anybody anything, and I don't know why she liked that guy. She just did. And and she told me on several occasions that she preferred me drunk, but I didn't let that deter me. But what it did, and it just to put a period on that, we ended up divorcing after 13 years, and I'm not even going to dive into that too much, but I got two sons, and a lot of y'all in this room know my two sons, and they're awesome. And they're living up here with me now. They're 22 and 20, and it's a funny thing to go full circle like that and to have them in my life the way I do. So anyway, life is going along swimmingly. The business, for good or for bad, it was a pretty decent little business. It was so good that I couldn't mess it up even drunk. Did pretty well when I wasn't. Ended up making pretty decent money. I mean, it wasn't one of those get-rich businesses. I'm not like, you know, Greg the Brick Mason or whatever. I didn't get millionaire rich, but I got enough to be able to support my family and have a house and go on a vacation and have, you know, a couple thousand dollars in the bank for say. I mean, it was a just basic little old business and ran it and did real well with it. So we did that and until about, I guess I had 10 years or so when things started coming off the rails. But what happened, though, and I'll tell you this part of the story because it's kind of cool for what's going on right now in my life. I'd picked up a one-year chip, and 3 days after that, I went and took a flying lesson, you know, because I'd always wanted to be a pilot. That was my lifelong dream, right? So I went to the airport that I lived 3 miles from, walked in the door, and I said, I want a flying lesson. They go, great. Do you want to, like, take an introductory flight, you know, go around and see if you like it up, down, left, right, all that stuff that we do? I go, no. I want the first lesson. Do you have anybody to do it? And did it. And ran through, got my pilot's license, and just loved it. Loved it. It was my calling. It was my lifelong dream was to do that. So I enjoyed that a lot and still do, because over the course of the next 10 or 12 years or 10 years or so, that became something that I kept adding on to that experience resume. You know, I kept adding ratings and going on about and following this track with no thought of ever being able to be a professional pilot, because, like I told y'all earlier, I got 7 DUIs and drug records and blah, 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 that's it. And so it wasn't really anything that I ever considered to be something that I could ever do. But I was going to enjoy that part. You know what I mean? So I did and got that done. And so after about 10, 11 years sober, I'm going to tell you what happened again. Because that's what it used to be like, what happened and what it was like then. And then something else happened, because I'm obviously only got a year and a half sober, right? Or a year and whatever, 8 months. So my marriage is on the rocks about 10 years in. And I'm still sponsoring guys. I'm still going to meetings all the time. I'm actually, at this point, kind of checked out anyway, because I'm going to a bunch of night meetings and coming home late and not being a good husband at all. And I get it. So I mean, I had what I deserved what was coming to me, but I read an article, and I've told some of y'all this. I read an article that said, written by a doctor, no less, that said that he had believed and had proof that after an extended period of sobriety, an alcoholic's body returns to normal and processes alcohol as if he was a normal, or she was a normal person. And that rang every bell I had, because this guy's actually speaking my language. And if you hear that as alcoholics, you know what I'm talking about. He understood that we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows, and yet said that he thought that wasn't true after an extended period of sobriety. So I was like, cool. Look at that. Didn't act on it, didn't tell anybody. And at about 10 or 11 years sober-ish, somewhere in that range, my sponsor, who was my second sponsor, I left John after the ninth step, because he didn't have anything for me for 10, 11, and 12, and I went and found another sponsor, which is fine, which is perfect, exactly the way that was supposed to work out. But I had another sponsor that I had the rest of the time, the 9, 10 years, Steve. And Steve moved to Savannah. And Steve and I were thick as thieves, man. We did everything together. He was a Taoist teacher. He was a sober guy. He ran around in a work van like me. So we all, you know, we got along good. And he moved to Savannah, Georgia, actually Darien, Georgia, on the coast, and kind of lost touch. And I never got another sponsor. Never did. I mean, I talked to some folks. I had plenty of friends by then. You know what I mean? And had lots of contacts, still was sponsoring some guys, man, going to meetings, going all over the place. Hell, I was even speaking at big meetings and stuff, man, getting my ego stroked. So I never told anybody about this idea that I had about the fact that I might be able to drink like a normal person. Never told a soul that. And had an opportunity to test that theory after it took me about another 6 years to find myself in a position. By this time, I had sold my little lock and keys company. Now, don't get me wrong. This wasn't like some big thing that required, you know, I sold all my tools in my van and some my customer list to a guy. So I'd sold my company to the guy that was helping me run it. And I decided and made the move to become a professional pilot. And I was flying around in little old airplanes getting paid to do it, and I loved it. I had, on a whim, had applied to this airline called Omni Air International. It's a huge airline in the what they call the ACMI business, but what their job was is to fly troops all over the world. They're troops. That's what they did. And I was thinking, this will never work, ever. Let's see how it goes. So I filled it all. They did a deep background check. Deep, because it's FBI, DOD, all this crap. They did a real deep DOD background check. It came back, and they said, Mr. Shivers, we're having a problem here. We need you to explain these two DUIs. And I went, what? And they said, well, it appears that in 1983 and 1984 or 5, whatever it was, 6, that you had DUIs those years. And I went, yeah. He said, would you care to write us a letter explaining that? So none of that other stuff showed up. None of it. Incredible. The days before internet, right? I mean, all my records are stuck somewhere in some file cabinet somewhere, because it wasn't all in one county, man. I spread my love all over the place. And so anyway, I got away with it. And the statute of limitations hopes up, and there's no feds in the room, and blah, blah, blah. But anonymous, remember. But anyway, so they hired me. They hired me to do this, man, and I got to fly these monstrous airplanes. They flew old airplanes, but they were DC-10s, and that's a big airplane. That's a big, monstrous airplane. And they trained me to fly it, and I got to fly that sumbitch all over the world. And so I actually kind of made my childhood dream come true a little bit, and based on my association with Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that, you know, and so it worked, and I got that job. So anyway, got all the way through training, and I got on the line, and we were flying, and what we'd do is we'd fly from somewhere in the United States, and we'd fly across the Atlantic and land in Shannon, Ireland. And it would, and the crew would stay in Limerick, Ireland, which is right near there. And at that point, we had crews really all over the world, but we had them stationed here and there. And generally what would happen is whoever brought the airplane across the ocean would go to the hotel, and another crew that was already there would get in the airplane and fly it on into Kuwait or Kurdistan or wherever it was going, Qatar, Djibouti. That's the side I went on, that side. And and so anyway, I spent a lot of time in Limerick, Ireland. And I was sitting in the pubs, man, because that's where everybody was, and that's where the crew was, and everybody drank but me. And they're sitting there, and they go, you know, they said, there's something about Guinness beer. When you're this close to the brewery, man, it just tastes so much better. And I was however many thousands of miles away from home at that point. Nobody knew I was an alcoholic, and I went, I got to have one of those. And I did, and I started drinking. And I got a little bit tipsy on that first drunk, and kind of hated myself for it, to be honest with you. I did. I went back to my hotel room, and this is kind of funny because I was the first officer. So when you're international, they actually think pilots are special. So the captain gets the best room in the hotel, and the first officer gets the next best room in the hotel. So I had kind of a little suite. You know what I mean? And I walked back in there. I was just so disappointed, and couldn't believe it. I said, God dang it, Mark, how could you do this stuff to you? You've done everything, you're blah, blah, blah. Well, it didn't matter, because by the time I had the next opportunity to drink again, I drank again, and I kept doing that for a long time. Now, the insidious part for me was is I would come back into the United States, and I would go to my home group, and I would go to meetings, and I would not tell anybody that I was doing that. This was my lie and my logic is, I quit picking up chips. First thing I did was move home groups. Boom. First thing. Second thing I did was, quit picking up chips And for the couple of three or four years that I was doing that, you never once heard me say, well, when you've been sober as long as I have, and, you know, or any of that crap. You know what I mean? Never once did I imply at all that I was sober for any length of time. But it's an insidious lie, and I tell you that hopefully because my buddies are in the room so that y'all can know that I'm capable of some pretty shitty lies. You know what I mean? In my cups, man. I'm slick, and I don't want to be that way anymore. So eventually the wheels came off, and the rest of my story is I got sober here in Nashville. There's a big gap of time in there, and I had some big jobs and little jobs and other jobs and this and that. But I ended up coming to work for a company in Nashville, and it was kind of ironic because I'd already blown through all those lines where, you know, first of all, I was never going to drink unless I was out of the country. And then I was never going to drink in my hometown. And then I was never going to have it in the house. And then I was never going to do it and get behind the wheel of an automobile. And I was never going to do it and blah, 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 blah. And I blew through all those, right? And about the time I was moving here, and so I said, hey, man, I'm going to move to Nashville. I'm going to be cool. There's a cool town. I'm going to live downtown. I'm going to be up there on those damn rooftop bars at these wine tasting places. I'm going to be cool. And got this job, man. And I ended up in relatively short order. I think I was in town really because there were no even false controls around me up here. And I was in town. I took the job June 5th. I commuted back and forth to Nashville until the second week of August. I was up in Nashville full time the second week of August. I picked up a damn silver chip, 9/11. So inside a month of uncontrolled drinking, I was sitting in a damn one room apartment with a bottle of scotch in my hand, passing out. You know. So it did progress. You know, the one thing I do want to touch on is it took me a minute to really drink into a good case of the physical allergy returning. I mean, the real live craving. I've had one drink. I want to have another one. But the mental obsession for drinking, I lived with it for about I didn't really that 5 years before I or 6 years before I actually drank. I didn't really have the mental obsession. But once I did start drinking, that's all I could think about. Whether I was doing it or not. I mean, the mental obsession came back immediately. And, of course, any contact with any kind of higher power, if you're an alcoholic, is gone immediately. You know? I don't think that God's contact is contingent on whether you drink or not, because there's plenty of people all over the world that drink and pray, raise holy hands and say hallelujah. You know what I mean? They can do it. I just know that for me as an alcoholic, once I was drinking and living a lie, I had no conscious contact. I couldn't find God, man, anywhere. And basically was living outside the idea of God, outside the idea of God. So anyway, walked into 5925. I came close just to be for the purposes of complete disclosure. I came real close to screwing up this brand new job, and it was so I came in directly to 5925. I was living out by O'Brien Club, and came into O'Brien and picked up a silver chip because I knew what I had to do, and I walked in there and picked it up and started opening my mouth and telling people what had happened to me and who it was. And one of the first people I met was Detox Bill Chisholm was over there, Bill C. And met him within the first couple of days of coming into AA here in Nashville, and very soon after that I met Gary, and they're still dear friends of mine. I see them and love them all the time, and they brought me into the circle of Alcoholics Anonymous immediately, you know. And within 3 or 4 days of me picking up a surrender chip and coming into meetings and opening my mouth and saying, I'm Mark, I'm an alcoholic, I'm a lying piece of shit. You know, I wasn't that dramatic, but I'm a liar and I need help. A guy walked up to me, came out of, just walked straight up at me. And he goes, do you have a sponsor? And I went, no. He goes, you do now. And that was fine. It was perfect. And I met with this guy every Friday at 5 o'clock and worked the steps up to the fourth step with him. And it was beautiful because it's exactly what I needed. Some structure brought me right into the house, into the AA house. And I met a bunch of people that I still hang out with. In fact, I went to their meeting last night. They're at the Three Legacies group at Belmont. And that was at that meeting that happened. And so I don't see that guy much anymore. But I am grateful for that particular bit of kit. So, yeah. So year and a half later, year and whatever, however many months it is, September to March is, I don't know, man, I was about a year and 8 months, 9 months, somewhere in there. I've worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous again. And I'm sober, you know, and I claim it. I do. I mean, I have a soundness of mind and clarity of body right now. And I know that it's contingent on my spiritual condition. And I go to meetings all the time, you know, and I try to share in meetings when I have something to share. I try to listen to meetings all the time and just be a part of. I'm an active and grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous right here in Nashville, Tennessee. And God has seen fit to create and around me a group of friends. I have better friends right now in the year and 10 months that I've spent in Nashville than I left after spending 35 years in Covington, Georgia, you know, and I do. I mean, it is that way. I didn't leave anything in Covington, Georgia, you know, and this place really means something to me. And it's a beautiful thing. And the AA in Nashville is amazing. You know, we're quite lucky. They call it some guys that I hung out with that come and we kind of fellowship together, and they come from all over the country. They talk about the pockets of enthusiasm around the country, you know, and I guess around the world too. But Nashville is well known as a pocket of enthusiasm for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm just damn grateful to be a part of it here. And if you're not, you need to get that way. If you're not, come with me. You know what I mean? Come with me, because we're going to go to a meeting. I know where to go to find these guys tonight. I know where to go to find them tomorrow. I know where they are. I know where they are next week. And I'm going. I'm going there to them. And got sponsees and working them through the steps. And some of them call, some of them don't. Some of them drink, some of them don't. It's just right. It's exactly how it's supposed to be. So I don't know. It's 9 o'clock. I mean, it's almost exactly perfect. We can just stop, you know. So, but thanks, y'all. Thanks for letting me share.